Hello there, friends and frenemies alike. This is Allison Dixon, and it is Ding Dong Darkness time. Back with my buddy Chris from 80s High.
Oh, yeah.
We are doing part two of our 10 Cities, 10 Mysteries series, kind of, sort of thing. Not yet. We haven't really fully established it as a series yet, but I guess part one and part two. But we may do something like this again down the line. We'll find 10 more cities, 10 mysteries.
That's right.
And if you haven't listened to part one yet, go back. There are some great little tidbits on there. Mysteries you might not know anything about. Some very little covered things. Some great historical things, cases, and some weirdness. So we're doing it all. And we did say last week that the top five was going to be something else.
There's some bangers in here. I mean, the other five were great, but like we're getting into some really fascinating territory now.
Yeah, it's interesting to know that like the top five cities end up having some of the most interesting mysteries. I don't know why that is. Like there's just more darkness, ding dong darkness elements in the top five cities listening to this show.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I'm happy to be part of that. So I am going to start this off and take y'all to a tiny little town you might have heard of by the name of Dallas, Texas.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
Yes. Now, there's no basement in the Alamo.
The movie references have already come out. It's great.
I know.
Oh, boy.
Now, Dallas is at the center of one of the most infamous murders in all of history.
Okay. I don't know what you're going to say, actually.
Oh, wow. Well,
I'm really bad about placing things geographically. Like, I could know about a case, but have no idea. Like, I don't know where JonBenet Ramsey took place. I don't know where Scott Peterson, Lacey Peterson
Boulder,
took
Colorado,
place.
Sacramento, California.
Yeah, see, I'm really bad at geography.
I get you. I totally get you. But, you know.
So help me out.
You and I had a little common bond over this when we were at CrimeCon.
Okay.
We attended the little seminar by one Cyril Wecht over the JFK assassination.
Of course.
President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in the heart of Dallas back in 1963.
Yes.
But we're not talking about that one because, well, there is no end to the amount of resource out there about the JFK assassination. And who knows, maybe I'll touch on some aspect of that at some point in the future. Today, though, when talking about Dallas, I'm going to focus on a landmark that is associated with a few gruesome stories that may not be true, but have certainly endured as local legend for at least the last century.
Okay.
And Chris and I, being a fan of haunted attractions and, you know, haunted roads and, you know, haunted structures. And we did a whole episode on haunting architecture back in season one. And this would have probably fit right on there. And this one's called the Goatman's Bridge, otherwise known as the Old Alton Bridge.
Okay.
And
I'm terrified already. This is great. I love it.
Now, the Goatman's Bridge is the what the locals call it. And so traditionally, it's known as the Old Alton. And it's a historic iron truss bridge that connects the cities of Denton and Copper Canyon, which are all around Dallas, Fort Worth, you know, metro area. Mm. And this was built in 1884. And originally would carry horses and later automobiles over Hickory Creek at a location that was once a popular ford for crossing cattle. So so this thing goes way back in time. And there are pictures online. You can look at it. And it's actually kind of in a wooded area. It doesn't look like a very populated area where this is at even now.
This is back when we had to caulk the wagon and cross
yes,
the river.
Yes, exactly.
Some great Oregon Trail vibes.
Good stuff. And when you're dying of dysentery. Now, the bridge takes its name from the community of Alton, which has since been abandoned, but it used to be the county seat of Denton County.
And what, is it like a ghost town?
Could be. Yes.
Oh my goodness. Could be. A creepy bridge next to a ghost town.
Apparently they moved county seats a bunch in that area around that time due to like water issues and whatnot. So they kept moving things around there as they were trying to settle that area. But the bridge has a very strong association with ghost lore and particularly a vengeful ghost. Now, this is where things get a little fuzzy in terms of actual fact, but you have to wonder how things pass into legend. So I'm not completely discounting the story that happened here. But apparently, according to the legend, there was a black goat farmer named Oscar Washburn, and he moved his family to a residence just north of the bridge. And he became very successful running this farm. He was selling milk and hides and, you know, all kinds of things from his farm. He was locally known as the Goat Man. And he displayed a sign on the bridge that would point toward the Goat Man's place so that people can come and buy his wares. Mm-hmm. However, this being the South, particularly in this time, and this was 1938, so
I was worried about this direction of the story.
Yeah, yeah. So there were plenty of Klansmen in the local government. And the story goes that they kidnapped Washburn from his family and then they lynched him from the side of that bridge. Now, apparently, then they went back later after they did that, they went back to the house and set it on fire and murdered his family. Wife and children. Mm. Now, very, very dark story there, even by this show's standards. But apparently when they went back to, you know, get the body from the bridge, they found an empty noose.
Oh.
And, you know, it's quite possible that it happens in hangings and whatnot, especially if you, you know, drop someone with a rope around their neck. A lot of times you can fall from the noose and it was sure. over a creek. He might have drowned.
Isn't it kind of, I know this is a fictional story, but the, was it Mysteria Owl Creek? That like really famous story about a hanging and somebody like gets free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Isn't it a hanging from that one as
well? It is. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty sure. And, you know, and so it's said to be because the Klansmen, when they crossed that bridge, they turned their headlights off. So the legend grew over time that if you turned your headlights off at that bridge, you'll be met at the other side by the Goat Man. Mm. And people have reported sightings of strange lights and ghostly figures in the surrounding woods. Visitors have reported being grabbed, having rocks thrown at them, and things like that at this bridge. And this is across time. And there are other versions of this legend. There was one that, in some versions of the legend, that he actually has a goat head because he had lost his head by the noose and then he went and like replaced it with a goat's head and stuff like that. So there are all kinds of things about this legend, but it is a historical landmark. It has all the placards and things on it, and it's just one of those things that a lot of people talk about. When I went on to Reddit to ask about or just see what kind of local lore there was around Dallas, this one kept coming up.
Really?
And so
okay.
I'd never heard of it before. So I think this is an interesting one because it does talk, a bit about how stories pass into legend. And I think it takes a grain of truth to grow that legend around. And stories about a racist, you know, murder happening in 1938 in that part of the country, sadly, not uncommon.
Right.
So I would not doubt that there is something to that, or maybe it was a popular lynching spot, and then that just became kind of associated with it. So
you can imagine there was a goat farmer
on
the other side, and, you know,
any
number of ways that tall tales can be retold, folklore and legend, all that kind of stuff. It's interesting to see how those kind of things evolve when you can trace the the game of telephone, if you will, from right. one telling to the next. It doesn't stretch the imagination to think that that was probably a place where lynchings did happen, yeah. unfortunately.
And there are a lot of articles on this, and apparently there is an episode of Ghost Adventures and BuzzFeed Unsolved Supernatural did a video on it as well. It's a short one from Dallas because there's a lot of history down there, and a lot of it's huge. Everything's bigger in Texas, so we're just going to... You know, we're going to pick a little small nugget to get going.
Is the double murder of the Mary Morrises, was that the Dallas area or is that more in...
No, Houston.
Houston, okay.
Houston, that is a Houston case. I cannot
come up with Houston for some reason in my head.
Oh, the Mary Morris case, that is a fascinating case. And that's an older prosecutor's episode if you want to check that out. There are other podcasts on it as well. But yeah, two women with the same name murdered on the same day, right? Or died on the same day.
Or within a day of each other, something like that.
Yeah. In the same general area. And for, you know, there are a lot of people who thought it was linked, that maybe they went after one and got the wrong one and went after another. And they're both really suspicious.
Yeah, there's even a case of like... They brought a ring back to the grieving family and was like, my mother didn't have a ring like this. It was the wrong Mary Morris. It was the other one who had died. Right. And so they've even kind of mixed it up at either the police station or the funeral home or, you know, coroner's office, wherever that had taken place. So, yeah, that's a wild one. But, yeah, that's right. It's Houston area.
Actually, there are quite a few other mysteries around the Houston area as well that we could talk about. But... Mm. That's Dallas. And no, okay. I'm not going to talk about who shot JR and that it was all a dream and I'm making a very dated TV reference. I couldn't get out of Dallas without making a Dallas reference.
If you're not talking about JFK or Dallas, the television show, what are we even doing here?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Come on, man. There's the only two mysteries.
Exactly.
Well, we're going to go back north a bit, but stay in the center of the country.
Ooh.
For one, Denver... Colorado.
Ah, yes, I do love me some Denver.
And apparently I like me some old-timey stories in these two episodes because we're sticking in the late 1800s.
Excellent.
For one, Alfred Packer, aka the Colorado Cannibal.
Okay, I vaguely know this one, but very vaguely. Okay.
So from my previous episode, we had Phelan and Hayes and this kind of guy who was very shady. We're going to see a lot of similarities in this case with Mr. Alfred Packer. And his name is actually Alfred, but I think it was misspelled somewhere, even like maybe on one of his official documents is Alfred. So
okay.
If you're a historian, yes, it's Alfred, but pretty much everywhere refers to him as Alfred. I might intertwine the two. So just know I'm not speaking weird. All right. So we may never know what really happened to Alfred Packer, a.k.a. the Colorado Cannibal, and his prospecting party in the harsh winter of 1874, because we only have his changing accounts to go by. So what led to this fateful trip gone wrong? Well, Alfred had served in the Union Army very briefly during the Civil War for about a year, but he was discharged honorably because he would have frequent seizures. And so much did he want to serve, he actually went to a different location, different fort to sign up, but was again discharged because of his epilepsy. So over the next almost decade, Packer's kind of slowly moving west. He's taking odd jobs and, you know, he's a miner for part of that. He's a scout for part of it. He's doing all these different kinds of work. But between his epilepsy and his awful demeanor, he wasn't in one place for long. Anyone who knew him did not like or trust Packer. He was a pathological liar, a thief, and quarrelsome at best.
Oh, boy. Fun at parties.
A friend indeed. We need to hook him up with Phelan and see these two dirtbags.
It's like the keymaster and the gatekeeper.
No kidding, man. Goodness. So in 1873, he encounters a team of gold prospectors. I think it's around 20 men in Utah near present-day Provo.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on an expedition to the Colorado Territory, and there's this big gold rush. Again, this is gold fever.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he wants to join this team, and they're a little reticent to take him on, but, oh, don't worry, Packer says. I'm a skilled prospector and guide.
Oh, boy.
I know all the things. And they're like, okay, you know what? You can join us. We could utilize your expertise. Well, over the next 2 months, again, this is November, the team's really not making good progress. They're beleaguered by snow. They're running out of supplies. It's so desperate, they're like about ready to eat their horses.
Yeah.
a line out of Hamilton. It's during this time that his inexperience is becoming very obvious to this team as well. Several of the members of the party are calling him a whiny fraud. They say he's obstinate, he's greedy, he's a bit of a mooch, my words.
He's
mooching off other people, fighting with others. He's also having seizures, which are stressing people out. So it's like he's an asshole, and now he has this medical condition, which is only compounding. I imagine he's not somebody you would feel very sympathetic for.
Right.
Given his, again, surly demeanor.
Yeah.
Well, it's January of 1874 now, and they encounter Chief Oray of the Ute tribe. And he has this reputation of being very friendly to outsiders. He welcomes them to the, you know, the tribe and, you know, their settlement, is basically like, do not continue on your journey. It is certain death.
Oh.
But I will offer you food and shelter until the winter lets up and spring starts. So he's basically like, free vacay, free stay, chill out here, let the snow melt a bit, and continue on. But these gold rushers, they've got some severe FOMO. Because if they wait the winter, you know, several months, again, it's kind of like that case with Phelan and Hayes. If we wait, all the good tracks are going to be taken up.
Yes.
All the good claims. Well, likewise, the gold might be struck if we don't get there as soon as possible.
Right.
So some of the parties are like, I don't think so. But there's a group, there's two groups basically that decide they want to continue on. And you have to imagine Oray's like, oh my gosh. He's like, look, not even a Ute tribesman would go out there. And they're like, oh, no, man. You know, we've been here for 10 minutes. We know the land. And he's just like, okay.
Oh, God.
He's like, well, if you have to go, he gives them a safe route. And he's basically like, this is still a terrible idea, but if you're going to do it, this is your best bet. Follow the river. You can at least fish and whatnot. Well, Packer, remember, he's a very skilled guide, obviously. Man. So he's like, well, it's faster if we just go straight over the mountains.
This sounds like the Donner Party a little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Wow.
And this is after the Donner Party, so lessons should have been learned.
That might have, you know, this should have been in their heads, but, you know, they didn't have Google back then, so.
So he finds a group of five others who are willing to go along with him and I guess listen to his BS, or they just had such bad gold fever, they were willing to, hey, we'll take this more, air quotes, direct route straight over the mountains.
Yeah.
So off they go in February of 1874, and what happens next, we will never fully know. Because in April, Packer emerges from the woods alone. He's carrying money, a rifle, and a skinny knife, all that belong to other members of the party. He's also, he's known not to have a lot of money, and all of a sudden he has a ton of money.
Right, right.
And so he shows up at this fort, and he's telling people what happened, but folks are getting suspicious, and he's telling this story to different locations. Also, like, you spent the whole winter up there. You look rather well fed for a man stranded in harsh conditions.
Oh, no.
And there's even men from that original party, again, the ones that decided to stay back or took the other route, who are like, they quickly tell authorities, like, listen, this guy cannot be trusted. So a council is formed by, I believe it's the general of this fort, and he wants to settle the matter. Proceedings are made, and what sounds like a very made-for-TV moment, during this whole proceeding, two Ute tribesmen rush in holding strips of dried human flesh.
No!
And Packer begs for mercy, stating he only did it for absolute survival. His first claim is that four of the men butchered Israel Swan while Packer was collecting wood, and they ate parts of him and moved on, but soon ran out of meat. And then they had the sacrifices slowly continued, killing and consuming Frank Miller, James Humphreys, and George Noon. Then it was down to Shannon Bell and himself, who rushed Packer with a hatchet, whom he struck in defense and ate to survive. He confessed he grew fond of the taste of human flesh, finding the breast meat especially delicious.
With Chianti and fava beans.
During a search party to find the dead party members, Packer tries to murder one of the officers and is jailed.
Wow. Wow.
At which point he retracts his original story and says, oh, the group made a pact to eat each other only if someone else perished and it was to survive the bitter cold. So basically, yeah. they all did a deal. Well, in August, an illustrator for Harper's Weekly magazine stumbles upon a grisly sight of 5 dead men in an area known now as Dead Man's Gulch.
Oh, okay.
This illustrator, John Randolph, sketched the scene as he found it and alerted the authorities. Can you imagine? Of the people to stumble upon this scene, it's a freaking illustrator for for a popular magazine at the time.
Sorry, I'm being attacked by my cat right now.
I think you've got a cannibal cat on your hands.
I think I do. You're talking about cannibalism, and my cat is eating me.
So remember, his account is that they're eating off of people and moving on. Well, right. Why are all 5 men found at one grisly scene?
Exactly. Exactly. It just sounds like, you know, he wanted the gold for himself, whatever they found and or had.
Yeah. So what was immediately obvious, as I mentioned, is that the bodies are all in one location, contradicting both versions of his story about dying or, you know, being killed and moving on and having to eat on people only to survive. So the working theory was that Packer killed and robbed the men, but got snowed in, built a shelter, and consumed the bodies to survive.
Mm-hmm.
It was unknown if the plan was premeditated when the small party set off, or it just, you know, kind of came about as circumstance. So Packer is jailed, but it's like in a log cabin, and basically he manages to escape. And he's found in 1883 in Cheyenne, Wyoming, living under an alias.
So that's about 13 years later, wasn't it? 1870?
Yeah, because it was 1870, was it four?
Oh, no, okay. Scroll. So
1874.
About a decade then.
Okay. Yeah. And in this confession, now I think number 3, he said Shannon Bell killed the others after telling him to go scouting. And then when he returned, a crazed Bell attacked him. And so, you know, he defends himself and Packer's forced to eat the men to survive. So once again, all of this is just happening and he's a victim of circumstance. Like he comes back and these people are dead or it's all a mutual agreement. And so clearly, you know, there's nothing wrong here. And, you know, at this time, the harshness of settling and exploring the West is not lost on anybody.
Right.
And there's a little bit of understanding that in dire circumstances, you might need to eat others to survive.
Yeah.
But it's not like, oh, everyone can be a cannibal and that's okay. It's like people will take that only so far at this time. Again, the Donner Party was something that was at least somewhat known of at that time because it had happened years prior to this incident. So it is... Again, it's something that is known and understood may need to happen, but...
It's taboo to a point. I don't know. I mean, the way that he described it, that Packer described it with the whole, like, got crazed by the idea of having more human flesh, that's something that did kind of happen in the Donner Party, certain elements of it. Like, they became very murderous as time went on. And so, you know, there is that sort of, like... madness that sets in. It's mostly because of the conditions.
Yeah.
But this doesn't sound like that. That sounds almost like he would say that because that's what people would tend to believe because why else would I eat the human flesh? But it's more like, all right, I believe the story of he killed these people and then realized he got snowed in and then he didn't have any other food.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and we'll get to it. He's branded a cannibal, but like, there's no indication that he was a full-time cannibal, you know, right. Like a serial habitual.
He wasn't a Hannibal Lecter of the frontier era. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It, much in the same way that the Donner Party is often misconstrued.
Nobody's
as,
setting out to eat the human flesh. It's like the circumstances force your hand.
Yeah. And if you talk about madness, to me, it's like... probably what it does to you psychologically to have to be in a state to eat another person.
Yes. Yes.
And what that just does to you and your psyche.
Oh, for sure.
And having to do that on top of the conditions that force you to do it in the first place.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. But to your point, is he malingering just because he's like, well, if I say this, like, it's just so hard to know.
Yeah.
Like, this guy is just a full-time BSer. So
Yeah.
He goes to trial and is found guilty of premeditated murder of Israel Swan.
Okay.
So he's only tried for the one guy because that's the only one that they can kind of link a death to.
Right.
And he's sentenced to death by hanging.
Oh, wow.
Now, the judge, M.B. Jerry, there's a very ridiculous... kind of hee-haw sounding quote attributed to him that's apparently on a plaque. That's, as far as I can tell, it's bullshit. Like, it's folklore that he's like, you done murdered all these Democrats, and I'm going to see you hang till you're dead. Dead by your own. You know, it's that kind of stuff, right? The actual transcript court proceedings, the judge does not speak that way and has a very even-handed. But that, I think, is something of a newspaper concoction. If we think news distortion for sensationalism is something that's of a modern era, it think again.
Absolutely not. And I think this is not too far from the era of Lizzie Borden, where that did see the media just sensationalize everything.
Yeah, because they didn't have Netflix back then, so they needed something to do. They need some form of entertainment.
There's no Casey Anthony interview equivalent.
Yeah, they're like, oh my God, we don't have Netflix yet for like a long time. We gotta think. We gotta think of something. Tales of the newspaper.
We don't have Court TV and Nancy Grace.
That's right. So, okay. So there's this, you know, quote that's attributed to him. But again, it seems to be very much ridiculousness. But due to legal nuance, the murder charge was overturned and his death penalty was stayed and a second trial was called.
Oh, boy.
This time he was convicted of 5 counts of voluntary manslaughter and sentenced to 40 years in prison.
Oh. So he gets out of being hanged, but he gets gets charged for the others. Well, that's quite
a lesser charge for more victims. Mm-hmm. And so 40 years in prison, which at that time was the longest prison sentence because it was more death by hangings,
right.
You know, kind of capital punishment as opposed to serving sentences.
Yeah.
Well, after serving 18 of those years, Packer was paroled, but not pardoned by the governor in 1901. And even this, there was a lot of sensationalism and buzz around the case. There was effectively a campaign waged by his associates to claim he was a victim of circumstances. So he gets out and Alfred Packer goes on to be a guard. He's a ranch hand. He dies in 1907 from stroke or dementia. He was rumored to be a vegetarian, a charitable man, and oh, here's the best part. And well-liked by children to whom he distributed candy.
Oh, dear. Vegetarian. These all have such an ironic ending in so many ways.
So Packer has become something of a folk hero. Books, movies, plays recounting his tale. There have been cafeterias and restaurants dedicated in his name, most notably the University of Colorado Boulder. Apparently the students have a memorial cafeteria named after him with the cheeky note serving mankind since 1874.
I am not mad at that. I can't be mad at that.
And there's other accounts very similar. Some places are offering like the Alfred Packer burger, things of that nature. Well, today you can visit the scene of the incident and the memorial to the victims near Lake City, Colorado. And there are also displays about this case at the Hinsdale County Museum. His skull is reportedly on display at Ripley's Museum in San Antonio, Texas.
Wow.
Also, if you want to do a little deep dive into the court documents, there's a lot of stuff on file at the Colorado State Archives. You can find chronology of the events, digital copies from the Supreme Court trial, his full confessions, etc. So there's a whole archive about it. You can jump right in and see what's going on. And there's also been, I won't cover a lot of this, but there's been some forensic investigation of the victim's remains to determine the truth of what happened. Yeah. So that's helping to decide, like, you know, looking at markings on bones that could have been made by a hatchet or an axe. They can start to piece together how much of this tall, shifting tale of Mr. Packer's, what is separate the truth from the fiction. But we'll probably never truly know.
I mean, the only thing that he seemed consistent with was that he ate these people, you know, to survive.
Yeah.
And that's really the only part of his story I believe, you know, and I think it's mostly because I feel like if you're going to do something like that, then you're going to try to spin it in the most acceptable light.
Right.
Possible. Whether the circumstances of the murders, we'll probably never know really who killed whom and what, but it just seems like the motive, the opportunity. But it is interesting when you think, though, of one guy against 5 or 4 others. I mean, there is an element of like there had to have been a scuffle, skirmish, something, because that does seem a little bit of a risk, a little bit of a daring, unless you're killing them when they're sleeping.
That's,
you know,
I think that was one of the potential theories, is he attacked them while asleep.
Yeah.
And you know, you could kind of get there looks to be a scuffle with at least one of them. Apparently, yeah. He's never denied killing Shannon Bell, but okay. He's always said it's been in defense.
Right, right.
So that has always been a story that's consistent, and that he ate the members. So he's never denied that part of it. But there doesn't seem, unfortunately, the cannibalism part kind of gets the front. Juicy headline. But really the question is, how are these men killed?
Yes.
Did he do it all? There appears to have been some, like, based on skull fractures, some people were bludgeoned, some were attacked with probably a hatchet. So what exactly happened? Was it premeditated? You know, those are the kind of things that I think are interesting and should be determined, just, you know, for the historical record. Obviously, absolutely, he can't be brought to justice anymore, but
he served,
yeah, just a crazy case.
18 years for a quadruple or quintuple homicide.
Yeah.
Lordy.
And I just want to say there, I had a follow-up that I couldn't quite peg in Denver, but there was this guy named Forrest Finn who had a hidden treasure, a map and a poem that people could go find a treasure chest somewhere in the Rocky Mountains.
Oh my gosh.
And I wanted to do this story, but according to him, the treasure was found, I think, in 2021.
Oh, you know, I think I might have heard something about that.
Yeah. But it could be anywhere in the Rocky Mountain range. Right. So that's obviously, you know, there's Rocky Mountain National Forest not too far from there. I'm sorry, Rocky Mountain National Park, goodness gracious, near there, but it could be anywhere in the mountain range. And so I wanted to do a treasure story, but unfortunately, it's kind of been solved, at least as far as he's saying.
I mean, there's kind of a treasure element in this one with the gold. And
true.
There's gold in them thar hills.
Gold in them thar hills. Looks like I have the next one as well.
Oh, yes, you do.
To my hometown.
That's right.
Not where I grew up, but certainly where I live now. Seattle, Washington.
Yes, I am excited to see what you picked for this one.
Heading to Seattle, and I have to say, no surprise to anybody, the very juicy choice would be what happened to Mr. D.B. Cooper.
Yes, yes.
The skyjacking man of mystery.
I know you had to work so hard to avoid temptation on that, because we both are pretty fascinated by the D.B. Cooper case.
But if you know anything about Dan D.B. Cooper, or if you don't, just go to Netflix, because quite frankly, you're going to find an amazing documentary that came out, I think, last year. D.B. Cooper, Where Are You?
So good.
Oh, my God. It's amazing. They end up talking to the flight attendant, somebody else who was like a passenger on the plane. It's so well done. They do some little reenactments. It's a great full coverage of like a little, you know, limited run series.
And they go through a lot of different theories. Oh my gosh. You know, there is the guy who's so hellbent on one particular guy and who spent his whole life obsessed over it. And there's been recent news on the case too, testing the sort of metal shavings from the necktie that might lead to a possible suspect. And even that is, you know, everybody has their pet theory on that one.
Sure.
But it's such a cool case. And I'm going to say that. I stand by that. It's a cool case, namely because nobody was hurt and he got away with some money, or did he? Because that's the other thing, is he might not have gotten away with it.
Yeah, because basically he negotiates for money and he jumps out of an airplane while in flight, never to be seen again.
Yeah. And they never found him. They did find some money in the general vicinity of the area that they could link to hit, but they never found any evidence at all of him, a body,
parachute.
Nothing, a parachute. Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's easy. I really would believe that if he had died in that, some evidence of that would have been found.
What if he fell into the Woodstock mystery hole? Did we ever cover that?
Case closed.
It all comes full
circle.
Wasn't
there was a podcast too that you were listening to on D.B. Cooper that did very deep detail.
Astonishing Legends had a multiple part series on D.B. Cooper as well.
Yeah.
They did a good job, but I will say that documentary is so solid. Good.
And it's the styling of it. It's just, I might watch that again just because I really enjoyed it.
I think I will too.
Yeah,
it was very well done. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing. So, but anyway, that's enough about D.B. Cooper, because I don't want to talk about him too much, but my goodness, what a case.
Yeah.
I need to try to go to the D.B. Cooper Festival this year.
Yes.
You can apparently do it. There's even like a restaurant themed, or bar, I think, themed after.
Yeah, they have different cocktails named after him and all that.
I'll have to report back.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, we're going to stay in the sky.
Oh.
But we're going to talk about a different case, which is probably, well, most notably, the first modern era UFO sighting.
Oh, my God. Okay. All right.
We're going a little bit outside of Seattle, but we're over the top of the Cascades near Mount Rainier, where on June 24, 1947, a pilot named Kenneth Arnold saw a string of 9 shiny objects over the top of the mountains near Mount Rainier.
And now Mount Rainier, for folks who don't know, that is the tallest in the continental United States, the tallest peak. It's a little hair over 14,000 feet.
Yeah, it's about 14.4. So, active volcano.
Yeah, it is it's a biggie. Mm-hmm. It is the thing when you see any landscape shots of Seattle and the giant mountain that's part of that. That's Mount Rainier.
It's part of that little triangle of Mount Adams, mm-hmm. St. Helens.
Yes, and is it Mount Baker? I think is another one.
Well, Baker's more up north. Okay. But Rainier, yeah. Adams, and St. Helens are like right there. And then south you get Mount Hood. North you get Baker.
Right. Right.
All active volcanoes.
Very much so. It's one of those
Helens things, more than others.
Mount Rainier is one of those that if it did go off, it would be a little like turning certain towns into like a Mount Vesuvius type situation, yeah. Or buried under mud at the very least. So
let's just pray it stays while.
Asleep. It needs to stay asleep. We don't need that.
Please. Yes, please.
That and Yellowstone. Shut up, Yellowstone. You're not going anywhere either.
Oh, good gracious. Oh, so we've got Kenneth Arnold. He sees these 9 shiny objects over the top of the mountains. He's flying between Chehalis and Yakima, Washington.
I know those areas well.
Making a brief detour to see if he could find this downed marine transport plane. Apparently it had crashed and there was a reward for anyone who could find the wreckage and report it so that it could be reclaimed by the military.
Nice.
But he gives up his search and resumes his course. And that's when he sees a bright light and he thinks it's from another plane. Well, moments later, he sees a series of flashing lights north of Rainier, roughly 20 to 25 miles away, and they're traveling in a chain.
Oh, wow.
At first, he's ruling out what this could be. He's like, is it a flock of geese? Thinking maybe they were, you know, based on the kind of pattern they were flying in, he thought maybe it's a new type of plane that was being tested given its speed. Or giving their speed, I should say. He said they were a thin, kind of convex, almost pie, pan, or saucer, or crescent-shaped objects. And they were kind of moving and kind of darting back and forth. He said almost like skipping stones over water.
Wow.
So they're making movements that, to his knowledge, no plane of that era was able to do.
And you said this is 1947. Seven. Okay. So it's after the war.
Yes. Right after. And war was 46?
Yeah, it ended in 45.
45, yeah.
Yeah.
So again, he's assuming maybe this is a new military plane that's being tested. So he's got a mind where he's like, I want to figure this out and use reason. So he's looking at landmarks and trying to calculate their speed. And as best he can tell, they're traveling at a speed of about 1,700 miles per hour. And he uses some math to estimate that. I won't get into that there, but that's 3 times faster than any known plane at that time.
Wow.
And this story kind of stands out because he is this credible witness. He's not jumping to conclusions. Again, he's trying to like deduce what's going on based on what he can see around him.
And you try to rule out the fantastical stuff. Yeah. In every way possible. It's how you should always look at these things.
And some of the obvious explanations are right. He's like, well, is it a plane? Is it a flock of geese? Is it this? And so right. He's really trying to go, you know, put it through the paces, if you will, and, you know, see what it is. Well, he ends up landing and telling people what happened. And this just becomes a nationwide sensation in the following weeks. People are talking all about it. And this is where the press coverage kind of gives rise to the term flying saucers, flying discs. This is really the origin of that based on his account. Now, he did not say flying saucers. He claims he said something else. The newspaper reported it as such. It's debated.
It's like D.B. Cooper. The name D.B. Cooper was also not the right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The alias was Dan Cooper.
Yeah.
And it was almost certainly an alias, but somebody somehow became D.B.
The journalist messed it up, and there you go. That's what we got.
And it's not the first and only circumstance where we know a journalist gets something wrong and it becomes part of lore. Like we've talked about Kitty Genovese that whole thing. And that was all because of misreporting.
Right.
That we now take as fact. And it's even psychology books about bystander effect. And it's actually not true.
Yeah.
Oh, we need to talk about that at some point. But anyway, back to these unidentified.
These flying saucers.
Saucers. In the wake of this, it leads to hundreds of reports nationwide.
Yeah.
So it's getting picked up in all these papers. And now, of course, not surprisingly, people are seeing unidentified flying objects everywhere. And all of this is what's interesting. This all happened 2 weeks before the U.S. Army issued, but later retracted, a report of a crashed saucer in Roswell, New Mexico.
Oh, that is quite interesting.
Right before Roswell.
I was going to say this is right around the time of Roswell. Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Very much so.
All right.
So this is like a preceding incident. So like leading into Roswell, you already have this like fever of what's going on. People are spotting things they can't explain. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on in the airspace above us. And so again, a few days later, newspapers are using the term flying saucer to describe these objects that are being sighted everywhere, and it becomes a popular term that has persisted till this day. Arnold later said that he believed the objects were craft of a strange design and made of materials unknown to civilizations of Earth. So he's kind of gone in the direction that he could not consider an earthly origin for these objects. The Army Air Force investigation publicly concluded the objects were due to a mirage, though reports further concluded something was flying around that area. Something. They don't know what. Skeptical reports from Army officials suggested the sightings were consistent with jet airplanes and that the P-80 fighter planes were flying in the area during some of the sightings. I think it was a newer, more experimental aircraft at the time. I don't think it was much long after this that there were planes that were, within the following year or so, planes that were able to break the sound barrier.
Right, right. That was all growing and by leaps and bounds at the time.
Yeah. So definitely like a huge time in aviation, mm-hmm. like a revolution in aviation and what we were able to do with avionics and such. And so you have to wonder how much of that is in the mix. And of course, if these are military planes,
Take a trip around like Wright-Patt Air Force Museum here in Dayton is a huge attraction. And you go through some of their experimental aircraft hangar.
Yeah.
And there's some wacky stuff in
there.
Really
wacky, yeah. Mm-hmm. Very odd designs because they're trying anything and they're trying to see what works. And, you know, and I'm saying Army Air Force because at that time it was still a part of the Army
branch.
Yeah,
there was no actual Air Force.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember when exactly it became its own branch, but
I think that was in the late 50s or around the 1950s, maybe after Korea or during it or something like that.
Because again, World War II is where the value of airplanes as military craft were really demonstrated.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, that's where, you know, you really start to see it come into its own. Anyway, so all of this is going on at that time. Other explanations, it could be snow-peaked mountain caps, mm-hmm. meteors, wave clouds, even pelicans, as they fly at high altitudes and have pale undersides to explain the bright mirror-like reflections. Because he was saying when they were like banking and swaying back and forth, the underside is what was reflective, almost mirror-like as he called it.
Right.
And so you have to wonder, could it be something like that?
Yeah.
But as far as we know, it is unexplained to this day.
It's sort of one of those things where, you know, Roswell gets all the attention and all the credit because you do have a crashed craft plus all the cover up with whatever they recovered from it, which is also, again, tied to Dayton in some way because we have our own sort of version of Area 51 here, mm-hmm. hangar something, because believe that they brought all that wreckage and what was in it to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Yeah.
And there's still always talk around here of, and I almost did that, by the way. That would have been interesting.
Oh, if you did that for Dayton, that would have been funny. Yeah.
I didn't, but it very, very nearly went there.
Spoilers, the next city is Dayton, Ohio.
Yeah. Well, anybody, who, you know, people got to know. Of course. It's fascinating, too, because when we talk about UFO sightings or strange aircraft sightings, and these are things that have been documented by the military, you know, the U.S. Navy released a lot of formerly classified stuff that their own pilots were seeing and all that, and stuff that just really defies a lot of explanation.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me how we saw saucers for a while because it was a saucer, and then the shapes changed, you know? So like triangular shapes or square shapes or just floating orbs of light, and, you know, and how an era is almost defined by the shape of whatever UFO is being spotted at the time.
You know? And this has a little bit of a callback to another season one episode about the dancing plague and shared madness.
Yes.
And how
I was thinking of that as well.
Like you see or experience this kind of group think, this group experience based on what's going on at that time.
Yes. And yes. And you might see something, but you've just heard this crazy story and you're like, oh my God, it's that. But you know, if you hadn't heard that story, what would you think? Or the pareidolia effect of, you know, you see a shape like that looks like Jesus in something, but you think of Jesus only because you were steeped in that religion growing up in that culture. Mm-hmm. Whereas somebody from who grew up in, say, a Hindu culture might see something else.
Right.
So,
or nothing at all.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of psychology at play with these things. And I love the discussion of UFOs just because, again, they force you to consider a lot of different angles, both psychologically and technologically.
Right.
And there's just a lot we don't know about what people are doing and what they're experimenting with. And we do know that there are very quiet experiments going on. So,
and we do know the truth is out there.
I want to believe. Oh, man, that was great. That was great.
How are we only down to two more cities? Oh, my gosh. I know. We've been flying through this list. I don't want it to end.
I know. This has been so much fun.
We have to keep doing this. This is a good time.
I know. This is great.
Okay. You have clickbaited me.
I have.
Dayton, Ohio for so long. Actually, I was going to say we're both natives here. You're not, but I am, actually.
Yeah. Oh, I see. That was what I wasn't sure if you were actually born here.
Yeah. So. And in actual Dayton, not like in the area. Nice, surrounding. I've lived in a lot of places around Dayton, but I was born at a hospital in Dayton. So
that's fantastic, man.
And I needs to know, because Allison was like, well, I was going to do a case and then something popped up and I did a little switcheroo.
This was last night.
Okay.
Like around 11 o'clock last night, before
I was divided attention.
I was going over my notes, like making sure I was going to do the things I wanted to do. And I just quite literally found this by accident. It was just some random listicle. I was just going down and this popped up. And then I clicked on the Wikipedia and I just fell into it. And I will say,
is it the Dayton Mystery Hole?
No. That's a whole other thing. There's a mystery hole in every town if you believe hard enough.
Exactly.
Or you dig hard enough or long enough. But I will just say that this thing makes me want to do a whole entire podcast series on it. So I won't be able to go into every detail on it.
Oh, my gosh.
But, Chris, did you know that Dayton had a serial killer in the early 20th century called the Dayton Strangler?
This sounds a little bit familiar, and I can't remember why.
I have never, ever. It's crazy because I love studying the history of the city. It's really fascinating. Anybody who is not familiar with Dayton, it has a very interesting history full of very innovative. A lot of inventors come from
Wright
here.
Brothers.
The Wright, yeah, exact birthplace of aviation. That's that, and you
to
know,
whom I'm related.
Yeah, exactly.
Although I'm not seeing any of those Wright dollars, but you know,
I know, right? Come on, I know, right?
Where's my check?
But you wouldn't have, say, refrigeration without the innovations of Charles F. Kettering, who the namesake is this town that we're sitting in right here. I'm 10 feet from the Kettering, Ohio border. But the Dayton Strangler is completely unknown to me. And when I started reading the article and looking at the citations, there was only one book referenced in the bibliography, which makes me go, oh my God, is there only one book on this thing? There's really not a lot out there.
Wow.
But there were other names that this was known by. The Strangler of Death Lane. The Man Gorilla of Death Lane.
Excuse me, the Man Gorilla?
The Man Gorilla.
Wow.
Yeah. And Jack the Strangler.
Ha ha ha. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually that was the title of the book that was written on this.
Move aside, Mr. the Ripper. Here it comes.
Yeah, we're not ripping, we're strangling. But there was a book written by Brian Forstner in 2015 called Cold Serial, The Jack the Strangler Murders.
So I'll just say, you know, whereas we could not find anything on the Lucinda Hewell's case, I'm seeing a couple podcasts talking about Dayton Strangler.
Good. I feel like I was completely, it's almost like, how did I miss this very obvious thing? I've studied crime in this town, and this took place during the early 20th century between the years of 1900 and 1909. Mm. And there are six victims that we know of five women and one man. And the interesting thing about this is that there were a lot of suspects arrested in this, and a number of them put on trial that were then later to be found wrongfully convicted and released. So therefore, the murders remain officially unsolved to this day. So I'm just going to like go down real quick, just the list of victims here. We have Ada Lance. She was the daughter of a very prominent carpenter in the area, and she was only 11 years old. Hmm. She was found in a vault in her parents' backyard, which I don't understand, like, a vault, what that means exactly. Because when I think of a vault, I think of, like, a safe or something like that. Is some other...
Yeah, a vault could be an underground area where utilities are located
or
something like that.
Okay.
So I don't know if they had like a septic system or something like that. So it could be something to that effect.
Yeah, she was found in that in their parents' backyard in October 14th, 1900. There was a party at the residence the night before. Sound little echoes of JonBenet there. Mm. And while the adults were playing cards, Ada left the house, but only a half hour later was her body discovered. This is before the strangling really became the MO at this point, because she was badly mutilated, apparently. Wow. Bruised up, a lot of blunt force trauma going on, as well as sexual assault. And they arrested a lot of people for this. So it sounds almost like whenever we go through this case, it was almost like overzealous police work going on, because they were just arresting everybody they could arrest for this thing. A man named Emmons, who had been apparently standing on the sidewalk near the residence, he was spotted by a couple women that said, oh, he was standing there. Then they arrested an 18-year-old named Harrison Blessing at a saloon. And then they found another tip that apparently this guy had stolen some things, and he was just like a kind of like a known thug, for lack of a better word, in the area. He allegedly confessed, though they ended up having to release him because he didn't have any evidence. They didn't have any evidence to corroborate the confession. Yeah. And that's the other thing. A lot of false confessions going on. Anyway, but we jump forward 6 years to November of 1906. And there was 20-year-old Donna Gilman. She was 20 years old and worked for NCR, National Cash Register, which was
founded here in Dayton. Here.
Yeah, yeah, used to be anyway. And she was heading home from work. She's usually was with her sister, who was occupied at the time. So Donna, she boarded a train car with a group of friends and then did a transfer, got on another train car. And then apparently that's where she vanished. Hmm. And apparently the situation was unusual because the night before she had just written a note to her lover expressing a desire to see him on that Sunday evening. So, you know, something definitely happened because she had plans, you know. So this isn't a situation of I ran off or whatever.
Right.
So on the night of her disappearance, a neighbor of the Gilmans heard something that sounded like a struggle in their home. Soon after, her body was found in some weeds 200 yards away from the home and on the opposite side of the street. The authorities realized that she hadn't died there, as the crime scene was visible from many homes. And so it was very likely she was murdered in a house and then dumped there. And so police, you know, barred off the area. And apparently there was a guy from or a detective from Cincinnati. They called him a Cincinnati sleuth, William S. Heitzman.
You know, he had a fedora and a trench coat. You just know it.
Yeah. And apparently he found a book that she had been reading on her train ride home.
Oh.
And again, multiple arrests and even a confession, but nobody was convicted. So I think what we're seeing here is like this, you know, rounding up of suspects and probably not very good interrogation technique happening here. Sure. And so a lot of forced confessions and false confessions as a result of bad interrogation. For and sure, we see that happen to this day. But again, it just seems to be a recurring pattern. Then we jump forward to August of 1907. So a little less than a year later, we have Anna Markowitz and Abe Cohen. And Anna, she was 24 years old. She was a pawnbroker's daughter from Covington, Kentucky. So just over the border here in from Ohio. And she had a traveling salesman boyfriend that was Abe from Indianapolis. And they were hanging out here in Dayton, I'm assuming due to his traveling salesman duties.
Sure.
They're walking along a lonely road near the National Soldiers' Home. So that's kind of like the northwest side of Dayton, or just West Dayton, basically, accompanied by her sister, Anna's younger sister, Bertha. And as they reached an isolated spot in McCabe Park, a man crept up behind Cohen and struck him with a baton. Abe turned around and was then shot twice in the stomach. Mm. Then the attacker turned toward the sisters. Bertha ran off in a panic and called the sheriff. And they quickly roused a group and rushed back to the crime scene. They found Cohen. He wasn't dead yet. He was lying on the ground. And there was also a trail leading to some bushes where they found Anna's body. There was evidence of a brutal struggle and subsequent rape, with her clothes torn from her body and her arms covering her eyes, and she had been strangled. In the meantime, Cohen was rushed to the hospital, and basically he tried to give statements, but they were very incoherent because he was just completely out of it, and he died 2 days later. So the only clue to the mystery was provided by a lady named Eliza Virus, a black housekeeper who was close to the crime scene. And she claimed that around 10 o'clock on Sunday night, she heard gunshots and a woman crying. Soon after, the voice said, "Harry, Harry, oh, Harry." The mysterious Harry was never identified. And the man who was convicted of the double murder, Leighton Hines, was later proven to be innocent.
At this point, they're not linking these together, it sounds like.
You know, I think that it eventually came later, because that was my question as well, was, are these being linked?
And yeah, like, are these separate incidences that are unsolved and they're like, oh, they're linked together? Or in the course of, like, by the third one,
yeah,
you would start noticing a pattern.
Here's the thing, too, is I think back in those days, they really weren't thinking in terms of serial
murder. I mean, that wasn't murder. Probably even a, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, really, until the, like, the 60s, do you really have that mentality? I mean, yeah, you already had Jack the Ripper, but really, he was an anomaly at that time,
yeah,
for the most part. Or you had, like, H.H. Holmes, but again, he was not kind of, and this, I think this is pre-H.H. Holmes or a little bit, just a little bit before that. And even then, that was kind of like, what? What do you do? Kill all these people? So I think, too, there was a little bit of that going on. Like, they just weren't linking them because they didn't think to. I think this is like, yeah, they came around later to like, hey, there's some similarities here. So in 1909, so again, there's time in between these two. 15-year-old employee of Kling Tobacco Warehouse, Mary Forshner, described as unusually pretty for her age. Interesting. Left the home of her merchant stepfather, Robert Geppard, in North Dayton. She was carrying a Dayton Savings and Trust Company's deposit book with $9 in it, which in that time was probably not an insignificant sum of money.
Right.
She was going to deposit it into the bank. But her movements after leaving the house aren't quite clear. But she failed to return and her parents became alarmed and they start a search party. But they didn't notify the authorities until around midnight. And so then they brought out the cops, but before they arrived, Robert Geppert noticed some disturbed soil, which led to a trail. It ended in the estate of Grafton C. Kennedy, where with the aid of his lantern, Geppert found Mary's lifeless body. And the coroner concluded that she had been sexually assaulted and then strangled to death. So I think that's the other thing that's kind of like now started to link these, the rape and the strangulation.
Right.
Not exactly clear how the first death, that Ava, who was found in the parents' vault, because I think that she was had been young girl, beaten. Right? Yeah. Okay. And she's younger than the other victims as well, but she's still linked as one of the victims. And again, a deeper dive and listening to a deeper dive podcast will probably bring a lot more information in that regard. And there were two witnesses that claimed to see an assailant. The witnesses were named Sam Morris and Mrs. John Sheff. Morris said that he had heard cries at about 6:30 and looked around outside and observed a man sitting on a fence and glancing at a dark spot in the fields. He tried to approach the stranger, who threatened to shoot him. Going back to retrieve a shotgun and fire off a warning shot into the air, by the time Morris returned, the man had vanished. Mrs. Sheff claimed that she had just gotten off a train car near the same spot when a man appeared out of the darkness. She began running toward her home with him following suit, but by the time she entered her home, he was gone. And in the meantime, another woman, Mrs. Powers, was attacked, but thankfully saved by her husband. The perpetrator escaped, but left his victim with nearly all clothes torn in her throat, bruised. So she was nearly another victim. And again, yeah. I think we're starting to see, yeah, a lot of repeating pattern here.
Yeah.
The coroner, upon doing the autopsy, found that the killer had abnormally large hands, as his finger imprints extended far around the victim's neck. 4 days later, a Pennsylvania Railroad detective reported that a man matching the description was observed getting off at a Dayton train car at Springfield. The suspect was a black man with a roughly bandaged hand, scratched face, and wore corduroy trousers with the same type of clothing the supposed killer had worn, but they never found the suspicious man. So, again, that could be neither here nor there. It's just one of those, it's another one of those eyewitness things. But it's interesting to find someone who matched the description, because he left a witness behind. And, you know, to have the bandaged hand would indicate maybe that was injured in the struggle.
Right.
Then we jump to Elizabeth Fullhart, who is the final victim here. So in February 7th of 1909, which is actually only, well, only a couple weeks after the previous victim, 18-year-old Elizabeth Fullhart was from Vandalia. She arrived in Dayton in search of employment. The day after, she mysteriously vanished. A week after she disappeared, two workmen decided to open an old cistern, which is like an underground water tank, only to find her body wrapped in a gunny sack floating in the water. She was fished out from the manhole and identified via her brother. What was peculiar about the killing was that Fullhart appeared fully clothed but was lacking her undergarments, suggesting that her killer had redressed her before dumping the body in the cistern. And initially, the authorities couldn't determine the cause of death because of the lack of choking fractures on the neck. And then some other theories were advanced, or some say that the bag was tied around her head and she was thrown in the water while still alive. And so at this point, it's not clear why she was lumped in with them. But after her death, there were no other killings. I think it's almost like, you know, this guy is out there just looking for vulnerable women to violate. And, you know, maybe he changes his MO, you know, here and there. Maybe he likes to strangle, but he didn't strangle.
I mean, they sound like crimes of opportunity where he happens upon somebody. It's not, these were pre-selected women for a particular reason, but more.
Right.
I mean, the fact that one man was spotted on a train and one of the victims had been traveling by train, like one of the earlier victims, you know, is it just like that crime of opportunity?
Agreed. And, you know, so those are the victims. And real quick, I'll go through the suspects. I know this one's taken a little longer, but dang it, this is like a hell of a case. So the first suspect is David Curtis, and he's known by the moniker of Baby Dave. He was 27-year-old stepson of James Curtis, who was a painter, who again lived near the National Soldiers' Home, which is where the two victims that were killed were over there. And described by associates, this is not my word, as a half-wit. I'm not sure if half-wit's like acceptable anymore, but I just wouldn't use it. Like improper and polite company. So
I'd probably call my friend a half-wit, not you, yeah. But you know, friend.
He didn't live with his father, the painter, but he did visit there once a week. And according to the father, ever since he was young, David had the habit of telling fantastical tales. Also, he knew who Donna Gilman was because he used to work at NCR.
Okay.
And so he was arrested following a tip from the Cincinnati Post journalist and then immediately confessed to the crime. So that's interesting, too. He immediately confessed. And according to his story, Curtis had noted that Donna Gilman deciding to board the same train and get off at her stop. So he was there around the time. So he's looking kind of like an interesting suspect. And walking on the opposite sidewalk and following Donna Gilman, he eventually crossed over, grabbed her umbrella, and strangled her with it without uttering a cry. This is according to his own confession.
Wow.
After killing her, he knelt down and cried over his deed, vowing never to do it again. Despite the length of his confession, though, it was harshly doubted by many, as he had falsely confessed to another murder 2 years before and was subsequently exonerated. And this, again, this guy is not... Wow. Terribly bright, you know, there's something else going on there. However, the coroner in the case made a statement to papers that he still believed David Curtis was Gilman's killer, described him as not very bright, but definitely not crazy and surprisingly a cunning individual. And on the very same day that statement was written, Curtis suddenly revealed that he was threatened into confessing by County Detective Frank McBride, who had threatened him with the death penalty. He explained that on the date of the murder, he had been distributing newspapers long after the crime was supposedly committed and only heard of it from friends. Curtis, having a habit to play detective, then went on to conduct his own investigation of the murder scene, which, you know, whatever. It sounds like he's just all over the place, this guy.
Yeah.
Several people testified against him, including his employer and Donna Gilman's brother. The defense team was well prepared, and the day after the testimony, it was announced that David Curtis was cleared of Gilman's murder. His dismissal was actually well received by the citizens of Dayton, who were happy when he was released, but the coroner still urged investigation against Curtis, but to no avail. So Curtis is out of the picture at this point. However, with the Donna Gilman murder, her family is still very much a suspect in this, because remember, there was like... struggle, actually. People said there was a sound of a fight coming from the house. They actually exhumed her body and put an arrest warrant out against her mother, Kate. However, due to her ailing health, she was kept under watch while her other two children, Collins and Fane, were arrested as accessories in their sister's murder. The siblings pleaded not guilty at their trial, with the 18-year-old Collins testifying against David Curtis, who he alleged had confessed to him as well. Upon hearing that there were arrest warrants for her children, Kate Gilman tried to commit suicide by jumping out of a second-story window at Miami Valley Hospital.
No.
But was restrained by attending nurses.
Wow.
I drive by Miami Valley Hospital all the time. So when I read that, I was just like, whoa. And this hospital is massive, and it's kind of foreboding and kind of creepy looking, too.
Yeah.
They declared that she was healthy enough to be transported to jail. So she was still on the hook for this. And Donna was apparently abused very much by her mother. Like, she was locked in a closet for long periods of time, and she was often afraid to go home. So there was definitely some abuse going on in this house. But on December 22nd, 1906, the Gilman family members were released from jail on a $5,000 bond. Collins was the first to be released, and then his mother was put in an ambulance and driven off to another hospital because, again, she's definitely got some issues going on. In April of 1907, a family appeared in court once again, this time including another daughter, Bessie, who lived in Germantown, which is this tiny town kind of like far to the south of Dayton. All of them were released on bond again soon after the family was cleared of murder. So again, we got all these people being arrested and cleared. On December 21st of that year, Kate Gilman passed away from edema, and 3 days later, her body was buried beside that of her murdered daughter. So the Gilman family was no longer looked at. And so there was like one more big suspect, and that's Leighton Hines. On October 10th, 1907, a man by the name of Leighton Hines was arrested on suspicion of killing Anna Markowitz and Abe Cohen. And it was later alleged by Sheriff Bowes that he had made a full confession. According to one witness, though, Frank Allen, on the night of the murders, he had seen Hines standing near the parks. There was like a little bridge in the park that he saw Hines standing near. And Frank Allen, the witness, was greeted by Leighton, and they both greeted each other. Sometime later, Frank Allen heard four shots, but he ignored it and moved on. And then the following day, when he heard of the tragedy, he quickly identified Hines as the man he'd seen in the park. And Hines' attorney tried to make Alan budge and end that story, but he refused. Mm-hmm. So on the day of his trial, Leighton Hines confessed to never having a criminal record and to have been intimidated again into falsely confessing to the crime. Hines was adamant that the assisting prosecuting attorney had abused him in the interview, and that the coroner and the sheriff encouraged him to confess in order to be turned loose. So that's a common tactic. Disregarding his statements, he was still convicted of the double murder, but was spared the death penalty. When the murders continued on, however, because this was in 1907, the murders continued after he was imprisoned. And so then they had to admit that maybe they had it wrong and they let him go. Mm. So again, and there are other suspects. There's like a whole big list of them. But again, it's never been solved to this day. And I was just really fascinated by all these cases of, you know, false confession, being arrested, then being let go after being cleared. Like, it's just a really wild case of where this overzealous police force trying to solve these murders and getting the wrong people. Or did they?
Yeah, it's interesting that it's billed as the Dayton Strangler, as if there's a person committing all of these series of crimes. And I'm curious, like, and maybe if you dive deeper into it, they get more into the specifics that we can't get to here about some of those common, what do they call them, like signatures.
Yes.
That you would typically have with a serial killer versus many people who were killed by similar means, but it's not attributed to a particular individual. Absolutely. Because it sounds like at best some of these individuals were only linked to one or maybe two cases.
Yes, yes.
Versus like, we can put you at the scene at all six, but to your point, it's like we have false confessions on the persons of interest side. And then on the other side, we have coercion from the police into, in some cases, it sounds like getting those false confessions. So it's just like, my goodness.
Yeah.
Is that even solvable?
Yeah. I don't even know. Oh, I mean, wow. It is. It reminds me too of maybe not to the large extent that this one is, but again, I mentioned this last episode, the Atlanta child murders, you know, Wayne Williams was convicted, but he is not believed to have done all of them. And there's still a situation there where the city is trying to pin it all on him so they can close the case.
Sure.
But so many of those cases can't really be linked to him.
Yeah.
And so I think there could be a situation here too, where there's more than one or whatever, but yeah, can it be solved? I don't know. I'm very curious to see how much court information and other records and transcripts there are from this case, because it's absolutely fascinating and I had no idea about it. So as soon as I saw this, I was like, holy crap. I mean, we even like have it's like Jack the Strangler instead of Jack the Ripper. I gotta do this in my own backyard. Right. I mean, what in the world?
Right.
So absolutely fascinating case.
Wow.
So thank you, Dayton, number two city, but number one in my heart. But that brings us, Chris, to number one.
It does.
It really does. And
I have to imagine this is a city where you really struggled, because I don't think much crime. I don't think much mystery has happened in this city.
Not at all.
Sleeper town.
No, we don't have hardly anything going on in the town of Chicago, Illinois.
Yeah. No corruption. No.
Not at all.
Old timey gangsters. Nothing of the sort.
Yeah. We don't have like the death of, you know, John Dillinger, or the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, or H.H. Holmes during the Chicago World's Fair, or, you know, any number of things. I mean, Chicago is really a city that seems to be steeped in crime and the mystique and the mob, but that's some low hanging fruit. There's a case here that's lived in my head for probably almost a decade, ever since I saw a documentary about it.
Okay.
On Netflix. And I don't know if it's there anymore, but it's called A Murder in the Park.
Okay.
So this one kind of ties together a lot of elements of true crime that appeal to me in particular.
Okay.
You have your murder mystery, and then you have wrongful confession, wrongful conviction, but with a slight twist. Now, the Murder in the Park documentary came out in 2014, and it involves the conviction of a man named Allstory Simon, and he served 15 years in an Illinois prison for a double homicide following a false confession.
Okay.
And he was released. He was eventually released. But first, there was already a man who had been convicted of this murder. It was a double murder in 1982 of Jerry Hilliard and Marilyn Green. They were shot to death in Chicago's Washington Park. And the person who was originally found guilty of this murder was a man named Anthony Porter. And he was sentenced to death in 1983. And in 1998, just hours before his execution, and after serving 17 years on death row, the Illinois Supreme Court stayed the execution because he was found to only have an IQ in the 50s.
Okay.
And so once that happened, there was a journalism professor from Northwestern University named David Protess, and he set up the college's Innocence Project, essentially.
Okay.
And where a group of undergrad journalism students decided to reopen and reinvestigate the case because they figure if this guy's got an IQ in the 50s, was his conviction even, did he even do the murder?
Right.
You know, this just doesn't sound like they got it right.
Right.
So they start to conduct a series of experiments to find whether or not Porter could have been the killer. Hmm. And the documentary goes through a lot of the things that the students did and the interviews they reconducted and the whole investigation. And because of their investigation, they actually were able to get Anthony Porter released from prison. And he became the face of the sort of anti-death penalty movement in the state of Illinois.
Okay.
Now, when I mentioned Allstory Simon at the very beginning here, he was the one that they decided, hey, this looks like the guy who actually did it. And so they were able to talk to his ex-wife and get her to say that she was with Simon when he committed the murders. And members of that Innocence Project, with the help of a private investigator named Paul Ciolino, came to Allstory Simon's apartment and told him the Chicago PD was on their way to arrest him and showed Simon a video of someone later found to be an actor. They set this up. They lied to him. Found to be an actor saying they knew that he committed the murders. And so through that coercion, Simon confessed. Now, he was convicted and sentenced to 37 and a half years in prison. And Simon's defense attorney, Jack Remland, was a friend and colleague of that private investigator who showed that video to Simon and got him to confess and encouraged Simon to accept a plea deal despite his innocence, which is how he got that 37 and a half years. He didn't go to trial. Simon then recanted his confession once he was sentenced. And the intervention by Remland was cited by prosecutor Anita Alvarez to vacate Simon's sentence. But it was not until October of 2013, and due in part to the investigation conducted by the people who did this documentary. So this is one of those documentaries that's like The Thin Blue Line or that recent The Submarine. Well, The Submarine Murder didn't really help with the... Well, it did help with the conviction of the Danish guy who murdered the reporter.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like that. This documentary, A Murder in the Park, is like it actually helped in the the solving of the case some way.
Okay.
So the Cook County State's Attorney's Office reopened Allstory Simon's case, and Simon was freed in October 2014 after serving more than 15 years in prison. And so the documentary goes back and forth between Simon, Allstory Simon, and Anthony Porter. Like, you know, I think they both appear on the documentary and addresses all these questionable actions by members of this Innocence Project who did all this unethical stuff and included that they neglected to interview eyewitnesses from Anthony Porter's original case and instead relied on their own findings and their faulty experiments. And additionally, Allstory Simon's ex-wife later recanted her statement in that she had been with Simon during the murders. Mm. And so this whole thing is really fascinating, though, because Allstory Simon filed a $40 million lawsuit against Northwestern University, David Protest, and that private investigator in 2015. And in 2018, the case resulted in a confidential settlement. And then the private investigator sued a bunch of people from the documentary for defamation of character, and the suit was dismissed. But the state of Illinois abolished the death penalty in 2011, and this followed the conviction and subsequent release of Anthony Porter, which now, in that documentary too, talks about this, is that perhaps they got it right the first time.
Okay.
Because there was a lot of other evidence that was going back to show plenty of eyewitnesses saw Porter running after the shots were fired. There was some altercation or known beef between Porter and the people that were killed. Unfortunately, though, the case is not technically... It's solved in the eyes of the cops, who do believe that they got it right with Porter, but he's out. Then we had a man who confessed and then recanted. And what was interesting is, you know, we talk about these innocence projects and trying to do the hard work of investigating to get these convictions overturned and release these people who were wrongfully convicted, but they completely got it wrong here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they actually got, very likely, the actual convicted murderer out. Wow. And then got another guy falsely convicted.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You think of these innocence projects as exactly what they are. It's like the thoroughness with which they do what they're doing. You know, I guess I never really thought of that. Like, wow, no, they could come to the wrong conclusions as well. And it sounds like some of it was not by accident, but just not doing the right. They weren't doing the right work. They weren't doing their due diligence.
Yeah.
And I guess you just think, like, if that is your charge, you are going to exercise an abundance of caution to make sure you get everything right. But the fact they weren't talking to certain people, yeah, that's wild. Oh my goodness.
Oh, it is absolutely. And David Protest too, he was expelled from the university. And also they renamed that Innocence Project. They assisted some other people in, you know, being exonerated and, you know, didn't exactly get it wrong. But because of that, though, that also helped them repeal the death penalty in Illinois. But this particular case is absolutely fascinating because it does show you can become very consumed with tunnel vision. If you start any investigation with an idea in mind or a person you're looking to convict, and you just go through all kinds of confirmation bias. And yeah, it can happen on either side. So I know I discussed that documentary in great length, but nothing compares to watching it and seeing both of these men talk and tell their stories and see everybody who was involved in this project. The documentary really does take a very interesting look at all the characters involved. But Chicago is, I love the city, and you know, my book, The Other Mrs. Miller, is set there, and I have, my brother lives there, and I got a lot of ties to that town, and love you, Chicago. So number one, woohoo! But that brings us to the end.
Sure does.
Our 10 cities, 10 mysteries.
We got it.
Yeah. We also have 10 countries, 10 mysteries coming very soon. So have that to look forward to, some international.
We're going around the globe.
Chris is going to become an international man of mystery.
International man of ding dong.
That's right.
Including our, let's just give it up right here. Our number one country, it's actually a continent, Antarctica.
Yeah.
They love listening to us there. No.
Thank you. The penguins love us there. It's pretty great.
The researchers. Yeah. It's so great. I'm very much looking forward to the international episode. I think I have some fun stuff in store for some of those countries. I mean, you talk about Chicago being hard to nail down. Try nailing down an entire country.
Oh, yeah.
To just a single mystery. It's tough, but I think we've got some fun stuff in store. So I can't wait to come back for those.
Me neither or neither. All right, my friends.
It's norther. It's pronounced norther.
Norther? Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm glad we cleared that up. You know, we couldn't solve any of these mysteries, but we solved that one
absolutely. Today.
And again, as I stated before, if you know of any other mysteries in your town, or if you know anything about the stories we've talked about today, and you have anything you want to add, reach out to me at ddarknesstime@gmail.com. Check me out on Twitter at @ddarknesstime and or Facebook at Ding Dong Darkness Time Podcast. And I'm going to be back real soon. We're still in season 3, so there's going to be some culty fun coming up. It ain't done yet, folks. And after that, who knows? the sky's the limit.
It's a mystery.
So. Yes. All right, guys. Catch you later.
See ya.
Ding Dong Darkness Time has been brought to you and produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon. It was made possible by an array of amazing co-hosts, friends, family, but especially you, the listeners. Big shouts also go out to the brilliant Nathaniel Dixon for the show art and future legend Spencer Morlock for all the music. I'll be back again soon with another episode. In the meantime, be good, you little ding-dongs.